face of death is moving, passing away. No memory, no comfort, only time is pain. The information missing, yeah, pretend. The prison of focus, where reputation bends. Feeling hate could hold, feeling hate could hold. Feeling hate could hold, with agonizing scream. Feeling hate could hold, feeling hate could hold. Feeling hate could hold, with agonizing scream.
Hello, Mike. It might be the new year by now. I don't know how the calendar works. We record this well in advance.
Yes.
So happy new year if it's the new year.
It's 2019, everybody.
2019. We're almost to 2020. 2020 is going to be the year. But this is every 2 weeks, Border Boss becomes like a music theory and criticism class called All Holes Filled, where we try and backfill our places that we left barren. By pursuing our base interests, we choose a couple albums a piece that we think are influential or important that we never got around to when we were younger, or that we just feel like talking about because it's our show, we do what we want, and we pick a personal one that should be within the realm of one of our realms of expertise, like metal or rap or something that we kind of we grew up with. And then we do a general one, which could be anything. It could be just, it could be just like the tracks of silence uploaded to YouTube, ASMR recordings. It could be whatever. It could be something, as long as someone can make a case that this spawned a movement within our, within our lifetime or within, whatever. So we do a general one, we do a personal one, and then we insult all of our viewers and their 19-year-old interests. With judgment and criticism of what they grew up with. And apparently we insult, actual people once in a while. Several people wanted to defend their position on body count. Listen, man, like that's not a bug. It's a feature. Like that's a feature of All Holes Filled. You're supposed to sort of explore the idea of whether you can get into a 19-year-old's tastes when you're 64. Like that's, sometimes you can, sometimes you can't. And it's a roll of the dice. And it's not a failure of you that you got into something when you were a kid that kind of sucks. Like we all did. We all like garbage, and we still like it. Like when you're an adult, you still like the trash that you listened to when you were a kid. It's totally fine. So I don't think anyone, you don't need to send me any more messages telling me why body count matters to you. I don't care. I just don't care. Like they're fine. We'll talk about all the Mike and I have said the word mucky pup at least 6 times since we started doing this shit. What, why are you worried about what I think? But anyway, so this week we picked rest in peace, Illogical Contraption. On the last episode before they died and were buried, Corey requested that we talk about Japanese hardcore. Corey asked, and Shelby said he wasn't sure. So Corey asked if we talk about Japanese hardcore, and I think they both agreed for some reason that they want to hear us talk about Japanese hardcore, which is a shame because we don't listen to Japanese hardcore.
Well, that's the point of it. Yeah.
But now we do. Now we're aficionados and experts in Japanese hardcore because we decided to choose all things that were either Japanese or related to something Japanese.
We'll get to that.
And I started with Gizem, the most obvious, the absolute most obvious choice I could make. That's right, I never heard Gizem before. But of course, I was aware of them. Gizem Detestation, it came out in 84. It's very old. I guess on Dogma Records, according to, it's like, I don't know if it really has, I feel like it's just the kind of thing that just whoever puts it out every couple years.
Yeah.
Like whoever actually has like access to a flexi maker.
I don't think anybody's seen the first pressing LP of this thing in many, many years. Like, I'm sure it's just bootleg CDs, and I'm pretty sure they're one of those bands that that's the thing that I'm sure people will get on our case about, is that I don't know much about Gizem either, but I have always assumed they're one of those bands that just have like 58,000 bootleg versions of their recorded material, and no one has their real LPs. So maybe I'm wrong about that, though.
It's probably expensive if you do, even now, but that shit's expensive if you do. But there's no reason. You can do what we did and open up YouTube, and you can get the extended version where they just stick tracks from MAN, the next album.
Yeah. At the end of it.
So I was of course aware of this band, and for some reason it's been coming up more often because maybe it's always been this way, but all of a sudden I feel like everyone's talking about their Japanese hardcore influence. And I think that that's always been, I really think it's always been this way, and I just missed it the first time around. All holes filled. That's like the point. But you know, like the most famous being Dwid, and you know, Dwid has been in the press a little bit more. He's been doing interviews and stuff and like podcasts with people because he put out that split with Krieg. So people are asking him about Gizmo all of a sudden again. And he will talk about it openly. So, you know, there was a whole string of bands, I think, when we were young. I guess Nine Shocks Terror was the big one. Like, they're supposed to be Japanese influence, whatever. I never really understood it because I don't really listen to that shit. And when I do, and now we've heard some of it, and I don't really get what makes this. I mean, Gizm, of course, like this, we listen to this and it's weird. This is a weird album. And even their next thing is still pretty odd. So I could see that. But, you know, in choosing this, I kind of audited a few other bands. I just clicked around on some other stuff. And the rest of it just sounds like hardcore. Like I invite you to, you know, tweet storm me about like how stupid I am. But tell me what's odd about Jeff. Other than, I think you're just reaching. I really think you're just reaching for something. Like, you're just like, you know what? I don't want to be influenced by, you know, by Anti-Sect or by, you know, like Discharge. I want something a little bit more than that. So I'm going to buy it from Japan instead. But this, you know, this isn't that way. I don't think this is that way at all. This is the sort of thing where the lightest amount of Googling whatsoever makes this album better, I think. I just pressed play on this and I was like, I don't know, man, maybe I should choose something else. Like this guitar sound is tough to take. This, like, the first song, there's just echoey vocals and voices and words just happening all over it. I don't like stuff like that. It's just a mess. It sounds terrible. The sound quality is not, you know, it's not even 1984. It's not even, like, there was metal out at this time. There was punk, there was hardcore, all kinds of stuff that was out at this time that was awesome sounding. This sounds like garbage. Like they literally recorded this on a Fisher-Price boombox or something like that. But, you know, if you do any amount of like looking around about this band, you know, like the singer was crazy. He showed up to shows with flamethrowers, and you know, so here was my misgiving, and maybe I don't know if you shared this, Mike. So we have the problem that we have 10 years of playing basement shows where there's a Gizm back patch every three people, and a lot of people had that punks is hippies image on stuff, where it's just like the four of them in these cock rock outfits, like holding guitars. I hate that image. I hate the phrase punks as hippies. I didn't know what it was about. I didn't know that they were Japanese, English as a second language or whatever, but I hate that picture. I hate that everything about that, because at the time there was a whole thing going on here where like punk was becoming cock rock, like Toxic Holocaust and stuff like that. There was a lot of bands that were doing like a cock rock metal, over the top metal thing in punk. And then all of a sudden Gizm back patches started showing up everywhere. I utterly despise that. And I thought that that's what they were, that they were like a punk band dressed like hair metalers, just playing, you know, hair metal punk. I can't stand that. There's no room in my heart for that stuff. I don't like Toxic Holocaust. I don't like anything like that. We played with a Japanese hardcore band named Goka. Didn't really like that. It was just pretty plain hardcore to me. I didn't really get it. So I look these guys up, and you know, it's not like that. He comes out with like chainsaws. He comes out just in like army pants and just like sort of screams his way through a set. The band is all kind of like weird. It's just better. It's more interesting to know that they were weirdos, that they were genuine weird dudes, that they were, you know, that this is that old and he was doing these weird death metal vocals. Like, death metal was around at the time. It was taking form like this, but it wasn't common. So to put out an album where you do this weird demon voice and sing all these weird lyrics. These lyrics are really weird. Even though, even given they're Japanese, these are really strange lyrics. I think he says something like, you know, stab a naked lady to this in one of the songs. That's a weird phrase. I don't know, but it's, you know, while this was going on, this guy was putting out a zine that showed you how to make like nuclear bombs and bacterial weapons. This is a weird dude. You know, like, that's okay. That's okay. Like, I'm not really like a G.G. Allin fan. I don't really like when bands are dangerous to their audience. What it doesn't really care. I don't really care about that. But it changes how I hear this album. I don't think of this as being some dudes who decide to be cock rockers anymore. You know, like, It just changed the landscape of what I was listening to. So when I listen to it now, it sounds more like this weird outsider art thing to me than what I was expecting. So what did you think of it, Mike?
This is a band that definitely has a narrative. Maybe some old man's going to prove me wrong, but I'm pretty sure they were the first to do this shit in Japan.
Yeah.
And Japan, they live in a society. And let me tell you, I think it's a little more strict and stubborn than American society, even in 1984. So
yeah.
Doing some fucking crazy ass punk music when it's unheard of, because this band started in like 81. Yeah, it says 81 was their first show in University of Tokyo. So this is a lot more ballsy. And I think if you take that narrative away, this is not good. But as Scott alluded to, I've never been into, I'll probably get into it more with my next one, but I've never been huge into Japanese hardcore. I'm kind of a weeb in other places. Like, I really like Japanese wrestling. I like Japanese art. They're like Japanese food. I like a lot of stuff, but Japanese hardcore, it was never a thing I sought out. My friend, whose real government name is Apple70Cal, he's younger than me. He was a younger boy, but he was like super into Japanese hardcore when I was in like my mid-20s, and he was like probably a teen or, you know, a late teen. And I was like, hey man, why don't you make me like a mix CD of like all the best Japanese hardcore? And like, and Gizm was on it, and Bastard might have been on it too, but I don't remember. And I just remember listening to it and going, yeah, I don't like, there was one band, there's a band on there called Warhead that I really liked.
Yeah.
And outside of that, it was just like, everything was just like, yeah, man, I don't know. Like, this is no different from any other world of hard, like any other country of hardcore. So I don't feel that I need to seek out Japanese hardcore. But yeah, I mean, I've known this band. This is like the most famous punk band. But yeah, this record, the guitar sounds like, it sounds horrible. I don't know if this is on purpose or these guys probably couldn't record in the best settings because they're a weird punk band in 1984. Mm-hmm. They probably can't go to, you know, the studio that Flipper's guitar is going to or anything like that. So I'm sure the guitar sound is not their fault, because the guy who playing guitar seems to be really fucking good. Like, even on the second track, he just busts out like this crazy guitar lead that's like, whoa man, your guitar sounds like absolute shit, but you can actually, you can shred, man, you're a shredder. And that's pretty cool. But yeah, I mean, just I said to Scott off today, I am very glad that I'm not saying it's never been done, because I'm sure it has been, but I'm very glad I've never come across a band that wanted to be influenced by Japanese hardcore so much that they took that guitar sound, because because it's just like, it's really hard for me to listen to. It just sounds so bad. It's like very fuzzy. Like, I don't know. It's just a very, very bad sound. I wish somebody could maybe remaster this CD somehow and make it not sound like absolute shit.
Yeah.
The music, you know, for 1984 is, you know, it's pretty brutal for punk or hardcore or anything. It's, you know, it's pretty out there. It's pretty weird. I just, at 2018, at 40 years old, I don't need to be shocking anymore. So I could just be like, yeah, I don't care. Maybe if I was, you know, the whole thesis of this podcast is, would we have liked this when we were 14 or whatever, 16? I don't know if I would have, but there was a lot more chance I would have liked it back then than now, because I wanted to be shocking at that age.
Yeah.
But at this age, I don't really give a shit that much. I can understand this has a great narrative to it. It's a great legendary band. Great musicianship and being very unique and kind of trailblazing in 1984 is never going to conquer horribly, horribly recordings for me. So, unfortunately, I mean, I think as soon as I posted the teaser that we're going to be doing Gizm, somebody already posted some other record we should listen to.
Yeah.
So maybe I haven't listened to it yet. Maybe the shittiness of the recordings has been cleared up by then. So, you know, maybe I would like their later stuff. But yeah, this is not easy to listen to in 2018.
One of the things to do that's interesting is if you grab a couple of these songs, separate videos, and watch them separately. Some of them are better.
Okay.
Like open, like if you start at the beginning and you listen to Endless Blockades for the Pussyfooter, which is their hit, I think, like that's what people want to hear. So that's a terrible song, in my opinion. I don't like that song. I don't like all the echoey shit that's happening over it. by the time they get to maybe this, I don't know how you pronounce it, but NIH Nightmare, Nine Nightmare or whatever, that's basically like they just get more and more towards being like a Celtic Frost metal band with twin guitar leads, harmonies, structure. You know, the solos get better, the riffs get better. As the album goes on, they get better and better on the album. So by the end, it's like official metal. It's like, okay, you have to get past the sound for sure. And that's a hurdle. Like, I would not have done it when I was a kid. If I put this on and heard that, it sounds like you plugged a distortion pedal into the board, which means there's no amp, there's no warmth, there's no nothing. It's literally just a just the fuzz of a guitar. And when he plays leads, it sounds like someone's like putting a Q-tip in your ear and swirling it or something like that. But you know, NIH Nightmare, Document One, as it goes along, you can't really get past the lyrics, which some, you know, tear their syphilitic vaginas to pieces is a little rich. That's a little much. That's a lot. But yeah, like I found myself on the other side of this. I expected to listen to this and dismiss it. Instead, I'm kind of into Googling more about this stuff. Like, I thought this was interesting. I thought the backstory was interesting. I thought the music was interesting enough. I spun a couple of tracks from MAN or whatever you call it, the next album where there's a very sexy X-ray blowjob or dissected blowjob happening. That's better. Obviously the guitar sound wasn't intentional because the next album has really, this is what they were hoping for. And that guitarist went on to other fame as well before he died, I guess. He was in like a more thrashy cock rock band, like a more demonstrative guitar band. But yeah, I this changed my opinion. I'm not really interested in this album per se. Like, this piqued my interest to learn more. And, you know, poked around a few other bands, and there's some other stuff that I thought was actually good, and I want to know more about it. You know, there's the band The Stalin or something like that is one of the first Japanese hardcore bands. That's pretty good. It's just kind of punk, but it's a little above average punk. There was a band I found called The Friction that's kind of like a no wave post punk thing. That was pretty good. So there's stuff out there I want to know. I'm sold on learning more about this. I'm not going to all holes filled much more of this because I think I'm going to waste your time. But I learned a lesson. So I'm okay.
Yeah.
Like, I still hate that punks is hippies thing. I hate that image so much. And I've seen parodies of it that have featured Lady Gaga. Boy, do I hate that. I hate mashups. I hate, you know, stuff like that. I hate that she was wearing a Gizem jacket in her video or whatever. Hate all that stuff. But the band Gizem, I'm soft. I'm soft on this. Yeah. I think I'm probably not a fan, but I'm sold on the narrative. So I've learned my lesson.
Yeah, I don't want anybody to think I'm a hater on this. I'm fine with the band. It's not really my shit, but it's not like something where I'm like, how could you fucking listen to that? Right. I'm fine if you like this band. I'm not gonna make fun of you or anything, but yeah, I just, you know, this record is rough to listen to with ears from 2018.
I do think people are overselling the flamethrower attack. You watch that video and he's kind of just walking around.
Yeah.
It's scary. I would be scared to have someone waving flame, but he's kind of just walking slowly around the crowd with like a hairspray can or something with flames coming out of it. But apparently he attacked a guy with that, like actually on the subway. So unless that's just lore or whatever.
Yeah, I think there's a lot of that kind of stuff surrounding them.
Yeah.
About how dangerous they were. So my personal pick is a band called Bastard, also from Japan, with a record called Wind of Pain. This is barely an LP. It's 8 tracks and it's 15 minutes long. Some people call it an LP, some people call it an EP. 8 tracks, good enough for me. That's an LP.
It's a breeze of pain. It just goes.
It's a breeze of pain. I like I said, I don't know if this was on that mixtape that Apple made for me long, long ago. I do not remember it. This came out in 1990, and even for the record it is, there's very little about it on the internet. This is one of those records I guess you still kind of have to ask a punk about. I got this recommendation way before we decided to do this episode from Matt, and I think Ian had a part with this, and they're, because I was asking them, because they're younger boys that I don't really associate with outside of wrestling circles. So I was like, hey, man, why don't you give me some suggestions? And they recommended this record. And so I figured I would never get around to it, because why would we ever talk about Japanese hardcore? But here we are. So I guess I'll start off by saying that I never listened to this. I didn't know what to expect when I went into it. But I've mentioned it on the show before, but like 1997 was like a pivotal year for hardcore and metal and punk music for me. That's when I kind of transitioned from just listening to like Victory, Moshcore, into things that were a little more dynamic for me. And I can remember, I think one of the first records that kind of swayed me in a different direction was His Hero Is Gone, 15 Counts of Arson. Yeah. I still remember I was at there was a club in New Haven, Connecticut called The Tune In. And at one point they built like a record store inside of the club so you could just buy records while you were at a show.
Right.
And I just remember like flipping through the records one day and seeing the cover to His Hero Is Gone, 15 Counts of Arson. I had no idea who they were. At the time, I worked at a gas station. And the cover is this weird painting of a terrorist type of guy walking away.
I was a simple gas station attendant.
Yeah, it was a simple gas station. He's like burning a gas station. And I'm like, this is a sign. I got to buy this record. Mm-hmm. And I just remember going home and putting it on. Because that was still when you were young enough where you could go home from a show and still listen to more aggressive music and not need to decompress for 3 days.
Yeah.
So I just put it right on, and it was like, I never had heard anything like that in my life. I thought His Hero Is Gone invented this type of music. And it turns out, you know, they were influenced by D-beat hardcore, like Discharge. And I guess, you know, Bastard, I can hear the influences in it. That's basically what I'm getting at. Once I got more in this music, Gehenna is another big one for me. They're probably one of my favorite hardcore bands of all time. And them, Nine Shocks Terror, like all these bands, they would kind of always name drop, or maybe them, not personally, I don't want to put words in their mouths, but when you read reviews and stuff, I think, you know, the snarky reviewer would want to flex his nuts about all the bands he knew, so they would always drop a lot of Japanese hardcore names, like Bastard. So yeah. I always associated with them with one of those bands where I'm like, I'm never going to, Integrity, like Scott pointed out, he was like, there was another Bastard drop for them. Mm-hmm. I just never paid attention. I fucking, you know, back then it was impossible to find a Bastard record. I don't know how people did it back then. It's right. It's amazing that this record's on Spotify, honestly, because even if you search Bastard Wind of Pain on the internet right now, there's not a lot about it. There's a few, you know, amateur blogs of reviews of this and like putting up downloads of it. And they're all pretty much the same thing, where it's like, this is the best hardcore record of all time, or, you know, this is the top 10. And, you know, I'm reading this, I'm like, settle down. Okay, just settle down. So I kind of like, I read a couple of those before I even put this on. So I was kind of going in this with a chip on my shoulder. But man, I will say, I'm turned around. This record, I'm not to echo these reviews, I don't think it's the greatest hardcore record of all time, because I think their influencers, the people that they influenced, really kind of ran circles around them. But for fucking 1990 and what they were doing, this is an almost flawless record, I would say. I would have to look at a list of like aggressive music releases from 1990, but I don't think there's anything that's beating this in the realm of hardcore, man. This is like the same year that Bold record came out, I think. And, you know, stuff like that came out. And man, this is fucking light years ahead of that stuff. This is just hard, aggressive, like nonstop, crazy, just fucking pedal to the metal hardcore. And again, another term that would be used in reviews back then that I'd just be like, roll my eyes over, is a blazing guitar leads. That was like a term, that was like almost a copyrighted term that people would use in reviews. And this has literal blazing guitar leads. Like, I am not a guitar leads person. I kind of always grew up hating them. I thought they were like a little too cock rock metal, but man, even the guitar leads on this, I'm just like, fuck yeah, these are awesome. I can't really get too verbose about this, because when you really like something, it's really hard to talk about it. I will say, on nitpicky side, the vocals are very, I'm a tough man! Like, they're very, like, they're the wrong way you're supposed to sing. You're not supposed to sing through your throat like that.
Right.
But, you know, it's fucking 1990. He's from Japan. He doesn't know any better.
There was no YouTube to teach you how to do death metal vocals.
Yeah, so, it's, you know, if you're going into this not a fan of aggressive music, you might find those vocals a little silly, because he's really talking like this. And it's just, it's not a preferred style of vocals for me. But I mean, outside of that, fuck man, 1990, this record completely lives up to the hype. I'm kind of surprised that there's so little about this on the internet. And I'm kind of glad about it, that this isn't some kind of fucking thing where some fucking 19-year-old is going to write in calling me a poser because I never heard this, because I don't think this is like, I think you kind of have to still be like a real one to get into this record. I don't think this is kind of overblown, like a lot of other things, like such as Bold. Like, I think this is kind of still a little underground, and that's pretty fucking cool. But man, yeah, 1990, A plus. Like, if I heard this when I was 16, I think this would have changed my life, just like that His Hero's Gone record did. Like, because I would have heard it a few years before His Hero Is Gone. So, you know, but I will say, like I said, I think all those bands, I think Left 4 Dead, Gehenna, they all have like a similar style to this. Nine Shocks Terror. You know, I think they're on the same level as Nine Shocks Terror, but I think like Left 4 Dead is, if you take away like sentimentality and nostalgia and stuff like that, I think Left 4 Dead, like all of their material, is the A number one hardcore music for me. I think that is, they wrote the most perfect hardcore music I've ever heard in my life. So I wouldn't put Bastard above that, but this is the blueprints for basically all of the stuff I really, really got into several years later. So I am very glad I heard this. I don't really listen to aggressive music that often outside of my job at All Holes Filled, but you know, I would put this into my regular rotation. I think this is a 5-star album. This is the first album I think we've talked about on this podcast that's completely lived up to the hype. Thank you for the recommendation. I'm sure there's people worried that I was going to talk shit about this or something, but no, I fucking love this record. I think it's fucking great. Scott, what did you think?
I think the first D beat thing you hear is going to be the thing you like, but a good one is a good one. You know, like that's for like, I can't really discern it. Like there's a whole genre. There's like every country has their own version of D beat, and some of them are very specific and people like adhere to it. Like Swedish D beat is a thing, you know, there's like so many bands that do Swedish. Even to this day, there's new bands forming right now that are important to people that are just doing D beat. It all sounds the same to me. Like it's all the same beat. It's all the same thing. But the best of it has almost like, pardon me, I'm going to go on a little flight of fancy here, but it's like Wagnerian. Like the riffs are like epic, you know, like they're quick and they're sloppy, but they build and they like take you someplace. You know, they're like exciting. And like, it's like to be a good D beat band, someone in your band has to have like pop sensibility. You know, they have to be able to put something together. So the first D beat song I ever heard was Disgust, Brutality of War. Look it up. It's super catchy. I'd never heard anything like it. I was like, wow, this is like a real barn burner here. This one's really going. This song's going for it. Not bad. And then, you know, the next six you hear, you're like, oh, okay. This is just what they
That's
do.
That's why it's called DB. Yeah. It's the same fucking thing.
Yeah. They name their bands Dis and they just do this.
Yeah.
But, you know, I'm going to back you up even further because first of all, I didn't know that this was a Japanese hardcore band or that it was a band. I thought this was just another Man is the Bastard thing. They put out so many different things. They put out Bastard Noise and Bastard. I just thought this was like a different version of Man is the Bastard. You tell me you're doing a Bastard record for our J-pop. I was like, what the fuck are you talking about? And then I bring it up like, oh, okay. Well, this is like, okay. So I listen to this and I like it. It's good. I don't really need this necessarily because like, I've heard stuff like, but this is state of the art. This is burly. It's heavy. It's perfect. You know, like this is like a really nice, gleaming, perfect nugget of this genre that you wouldn't need anything else. I don't think. Like,
it's 15 minutes, man. That's the fucking perfect time for a record. That's all I want to hear.
At 15 minutes, it's varied enough. There's different, you know, there's different parts. You're going to remember songs. There's like riffs. There's like moments. You're going to like, oh, this is great. I'm on like a little cloud right here. I'm like taking on a wave. So you're going to go someplace with it. It's fine. And it unlocks some information for me because I've known bands and I've been friends with. So, you know, when I was a kid, not when I was a kid, but when I was younger, several of our friends formed a band called Devoid of Faith.
Yeah.
With a, like, you know, which eventually I ended up taking over for that singer in a band called To Hell and Back. He kind of sings like this kind of Grover, like hard Grover.
Yeah.
You know, like that's kind of what it sounds like. And, you know, in the right setting, it's awesome, but it really, really has to be the right setting. Like this kind of vocalist has to find his way to nestle down like a tick into the guitars. So if your guitars aren't heavy and your drums aren't blasting and your bass isn't like way, way like jet engine distorted, you're not going to get it. So quit your D beat band right now. If you don't have the gear to like bury that like Grover vocalist in like a whirlwind of torment, it's not going to work out. But when they do it, it's great. Like there's no, you can't complain about this. What's there to complain about? You know, it's like, it delivers, it's accurately done, it's exciting, it's like a little bit, it's just messy enough that you know real people are doing it, and it's from 1990, 1992, whatever it's from. It's from like an odd time for, you know.
Yeah, it originally came out in 1990, and then I think it was repressed in 92.
It's very burly. That's what I think when I listen to it. I'm like, man, this is like muscular. Yeah. It's like really aggressive album. Doesn't really stick around too long, and it doesn't really like leave much behind it. So it's cool. I didn't even know this was a band. So I'm doubly enlightened. It's fine. I don't really care about D-Beat that much, so it's not like I'm not gonna like probably go back and get any more of this. But I'm fine with it. It's like, oh yeah, that's good. It's like, but this is exactly what I'm talking about. Because like I said, you can pick any D-Beat band that's good, and there's a lot of them, and that can be the one that you like ride for. So if you're like, well, you know, I'm influenced by Bastard, you did that on purpose. You look for the one that's hard, that's expensive. Yeah, I mean, I could be influenced by, you know, Disrupt, by, you know, Disgorge, Disfetus, Disass, like these nuts. But, you know, most of my influence comes from Bastard. Well, you know, their influence comes from Discharge. They sound exactly like Discharge. So they just sound like a really heavy, awesome Discharge. So it's fine. Like, I definitely enjoy it. Would you have liked it when you were a kid, though? You said His Hero's Gone, and I get that. It's definitely in the ballpark. But I think His Hero is Gone and some of those other bands are more interesting. Like, they're more metallic. They have riffs. You know, they don't just play the four on the floor. They go in some directions that keeps you engaged. And I don't think, like, the actual D-Beat bands kind of don't do that. They just blister. They just, like...
Yeah. Yeah, no, I understand. But... I think I would have gravitated towards this. It really honestly depends on the month I heard it, but
right.
But yeah, I mean, the other D-Beat band I like really enjoy is this band Driller Killer, and they're kind of they're like right on that borderline of being something else besides D-Beat, but you know, they have the crazy vocals too. But yeah, I'm not a D-Beat veteran or anything, but this is definitely the best out of that genre I've heard.
Yeah. Pretty sweet. Are they still around?
No, I don't think so. I think I read that. I think the guitarist went into a band called Judgment, I think, after this.
Oh, Judgment's pretty good. It's like 90s metalcore.
Yeah.
it's not bad. Yeah. One of the bands that I like, actually, that I was like, oh, maybe I'll look back into this because this is more my speed.
Yeah.
So my next album, we're going into some gray territory here. We're going to get into even grayer territory given today's topic, but the gray territory. So, you know, I talked to Mike and I was like, I kind of want to do something more like your final choice where it's a little, you know, whatever. But, you know, you mentioned a couple bands and you mentioned Flipper's Guitar. And I was like, I looked them up and it says that they're into, you know, Aztec Camera and the Style Council. So for people who don't know this, there's a thing, you know this, but you may not know the term. There's a thing from the 80s. The bands, you know, it's one of my favorite things other than actual new wave, which was, you know, Level 42, Swing Out Sister, ABC, those kind of bands. They did this thing called, pardon the expression. They did this thing called sophistopop. It's a terrible term. And it was made to be slick. It's made to be like kind of jazzy. Like, I think these people all grew up in shit neighborhoods. So it's kind of like, you know, when you wear nice clothes, but you live in a shit town, it's like they were putting on airs. Like, that's the genre was, you know, we're going to be spies and like debonair, you know, dandies and stuff like that. But, you know, we come from, you know, Sheffield, like, you know, an industrial town or something like that. And, you know, it was jazzy. If you listen to it, it's kind of, so here's a good example. Everybody knows Smooth Operator by Sade, right? And you know how the chords are weird in that song. Like, she hangs on notes that are kind of wrong and it's cool. That's like what I like about sophistopop. This band's supposed to be that. They're not. they don't really do that. So Flippers. So for another thing that I didn't know about this. So some people who are from 35 to 45 years old now, then maybe their ears will perk up on this. The reason Flippers Guitar is notable is that it's Cornelius's band. Keigo Oyamada. He came over here in, I think, the late 90s, early 2000s as Cornelius with a breakthrough album. But I don't think it really took off. He's still a name, you know, it went places and stuff like that, but he didn't really, you know, he didn't.
Yeah, man. To paint a picture for people who are too young to read magazines, they pushed the shit out of that record.
It was everywhere. Yeah. It was everywhere. It had a cool cover that was easy to print. It was like this bright orange, like, illustration of his face smoking a cigarette over. It was called Phantasma. And it's okay. It's like, I knew this album. So this All Holes Filled is kind of bullshit. But, like, I knew that album. I tried with him. And I didn't know that this was his, I wondered where I heard this name before, and then didn't really put it together. So I listened to the album and I just decided to roll with it. Cause it doesn't sound like him exactly, but it's the same type of stuff. So, you know, you told me that there was a band called Flipper's Guitar that was, you know, recommended highly for Japanese, you know, crossover stuff or whatever. And I was thinking it was going to be like punk, heavy, sludge, grunge. Cause it's Flipper's Guitar. Yeah. It's a band called Flipper. They're like a heavy, you know, early pre-grunge punk whatever kind of band. I thought it was related to that. I don't know what the name is related to at all, because it's nothing. It's not even slightly heavy. I don't even think there's a distortion pedal in the studio. It's really like poppy and really like mild. And you know, these people went on to produce, you know, Pizzicato 5. So if that name means anything to you, then maybe you know the direction we're going in here, you know. So it's like if you see something where someone does an outline drawing of a painting, like all the colors gone, but if you could still tell what it is, that's kind of what I think these guys did. They like picked the idea of sophisticated pop, but didn't take any of the harmonies with them. They didn't take any of the odd slick production. It sounds like 60s sunshine pop to me for the most part. There's some new wave stuff. There's some synth. There's some noise that happens here and there, but like this, it is really like advanced kind of 60s influence pop. You know, it goes some weird places. It's a lot of like crazy melodies and a lot of like big production, but there's no specific sound. Like they have one song that's all sung by women that aren't anywhere else on the album. Like, you know, they have another song that's like a synth, like a hard, almost a hard synth pop song. And, you know, it's like the sound is all over the place. It's kind of, you know, it's a little too much variety for what I was hoping for. It doesn't really hit the beats of what they're influenced by that I thought, but it's not bad. It's perfect. It's like really, really good pop music, really competently executed. But he also does the whispery vocals. Like he sings really soft and kind of whispery all the time. He sings multiple tracks, but doesn't really harmonize. He just kind of doubles his vocals. And, I don't know, like it was cool. Like I think it was interesting, but I didn't love it until maybe there's a song, maybe three quarters of the way through the album called Southbound Excursion. All of a sudden they hit it out of nowhere. He's like, oh, you came here for this shit. I got you. And he does this like the crazy melodies. He's all over the place. He's doing all this weird stuff and all this like advanced pop stuff. And then he kind of stays there after that. The next song after that is all weird harmonies and weird stuff. And it's like, why did you wait till track 10 for this, dude? I came all the way from America to hear your album and you fucked with me. So, you know, track 2, and then skip everything, and then track 10, and then from then on. You know, that's kind of where I landed with this. What did you think of it, Mike?
So, as Scott mentioned, when we were going over the what we're going to do for this, I found this record on a list of... It's on some bullshit website. It's not like Rolling Stone or some verified website. It was like, you know, ratemymusic.com or one of those bullshit right. websites. But there was some listicle that was like top 100... Japanese albums as voted on by actual Japanese people. Yeah. And I think that's cool. Like it's, you know, yeah. I would like to know what Japanese people actually consider their best albums. And this was either number one or within the top 10. Yeah. So, you know, even if they only polled 100 Japanese people, it's still, you know, it's pretty highly regarded. And Scott pretty much summed it up. This is like, basically, when I was younger and you had to read books to gain knowledge, I used to like just like fucking lurk around the Barnes and Noble and Borders discount racks, just like looking for anything cool. And there was a book, and I swear it was called Japan Pop, but I'm like looking at it on the internet right now, and I'm not being proven right. But there was a book that was just all about Japanese music, and it had like a beautiful layout, and it was like $5, and I bought it. And that was back way before you could even think about just going on the internet and searching for a Japanese band to see what they sounded like. And so, you know, I read this book, you know, cover to cover. I had it for years before I would hear most of the bands on it. Like there was, you know, it's so outdated at this point, but it was like common shit like East End Yuri, which is like, you know, before anybody's time with the internet. Yep. But that was, you know, one of the first big like kind of like modern rap hits in Japan. And, you know, stuff like Pizzicato 5, which is what this would be, like, most akin to. And that's kind of what I'm getting at, is that I would just imagine what these bands and these people sounded like, because I had no idea what they sounded like. I couldn't really pick up on cues of, you know, the writing at that time because I was an idiot. And so I would just imagine. And you know, a lot of the time when I finally heard them years later, it would be this kind of like, let's take like 38 genres of music and just make some real clean sound and pop music to it. And I'm fine with that. If I want to be honest with myself, my most favorite music of all time to ever come out of Japan is definitely the soundtrack to Katamari Damacy.
Yeah.
That is my number one record, and I kind of peeked at my Christmas gifts. And this is, you know, you're hearing this in 2019, but we're recording before Christmas. I'm getting that soundtrack, and finally, on like an actual record, and I'm fucking pumped because it's not on Spotify, and it's, you know, it's on my iPod from 2006 that I haven't had for a very long time. I'm very sick of listening to that soundtrack on YouTube like a loser, so I'm very pumped to get that soundtrack, and and I would compare this record outside of Pizzicato 5 to something like Katamari Damacy, where it's just like a collection of songs. There's nothing really that cohesive about them.
Yeah.
They're just throwing shit at the wall, and I'm fine with that. Like I said, it's nothing. You know, I don't think I'm not Japanese. Maybe they take something out of this that they could like latch onto and really grab onto. But I think this is perfect background music. It's nothing. You know, I'm gonna fucking be a fanatic over or anything like that. So it's kind of crazy that any list would rank this so highly, but I understand it. It's easy to listen to.
Yeah.
It's, you know, again, for the early 90s or whenever it is, it's pretty clean production. I think I think a lot of Japanese music, it doesn't even matter what genre, has like squeaky clean production, and this definitely has it. So it's fine. I don't understand the big deal to Japanese people, and I could understand why it hasn't penetrated Hong Kong America or anything like that. And I do think Pizzicato 5 is a way better version of this band. Yeah. And
They're just more fun.
And this guy went on to produce Pizzicato 5. So it all makes sense. It's a fine record. If you're looking for something different, I do think everybody who's into music should listen to something that sounds like this at least once in their life. So if you've never heard the Katamari Damacy record or Pizzicato 5 or even Cornelius or anything like that, just, you know, check out this record because it, you know, you might really dig this. This could really be somebody's shit. Like this kind of just throw shit to the wall pop music is, I think, it's much more interesting than K-pop and, you know, standard J-pop. So, you know, this might be your thing. So definitely check it out. It's not didn't blow my dick back or anything, but it's a perfectly fine record.
So for the whole middle of this album is kind of just like pop with acoustic strummy guitars. There's like a lot of stuff like that. And when I was young, I had like an actual Japanese friend from Japan, and I said, you know, just tape some radio, just because I'm a kid and I'm like a dork. I'm like, just bring me back, you know, what's going on over there? Bring me back. She brought me back a videotape of just, you know, she just hit record on stuff and gave me all this stuff, and she gave me a tape that was just whatever was poppy. And there was a, you know, a song, a big, like, you know, just a big adult contemporary song or something by Fumiya Fuji called Do Not. It just sounds like that. Like, so this sound was on the radio, like this sunny, yeah, gentle, folky, you know, whatever you want to call it. It's interspersed with weird stuff. There's a lot of odd stuff. And this guy, Cornelius Kegoromada in particular, is into like putting noises, like squeak, squeak, scritchy, scratchy, like just digital sounds and like stuff on top of things. That's why I didn't like Phantasma. And then he's also really good at finding and producing stuff that just doesn't hit it. So one of his big projects in the 90s that I think flopped was Kahimikari. Kahimikari was like one of his, you know, proteges or whatever in America that he was, you know, he was on an American label by then. He was like, fuck it, I'm bringing everybody over here. And he brought her over and, you know, tried to produce her thing. And it's the same thing. It's like, it's good, but who would want to listen to this? It's just, it's whispery vocals. It's just kind of bland pop with nothing that's really like, it's not going that wild. And Pizzicato 5 was wild. You listen to Pizzicato 5 and they're actually like, they're really crazy, like Austin Powers, 60, you know, 60s rave up, laughing, you know, like plus on top of that, you know, like then the new wave, they're all kinds of other things. So like they had a thing going, they had a look, they had like a presentation. And, you know, I think just a schlubby guy showing up and trying to do the same thing wasn't really gonna, and he is, look at pictures of him. He's just a schlubby guy. But, you know, he's still around. He put out something like not all that long ago, but I have a DVD of his that's still in the wrapper. He put out something called Dot that was more experimental and more odd. It's 10 feet away from me. It's never been unwrapped in 15 years that I've owned that DVD, and it's not gonna. It's not in any danger of being unwrapped anytime soon.
Speaking of something like that that's been on the rack for 15 years, my next pick is Sparks, Kimono My House. Yeah, Kimono My House by Sparks. This is from 1974. That is basically my story. I have owned this record. I don't know. I inherited it at some point within the last 10 years. And I was going through my record collection the other day looking for something. And I stumbled on this and I was just like, what is it? I was like, oh, yeah, this is that record, that Sparks record. Because there's no title on the actual record. There's no, right. It's like, this, I think the CD has a title. But anyway, and I was like, oh, I got to put that on the list because I've never actually listened to this band. So this is kind of what in the podcast town world we call a Fredo pick, which is when you do something on a themed episode of a podcast and you just make it stupid, but it's vaguely related to the topic. So there's, you know, obviously this band's not from Japan, but it's Kimono My House and it's Japanese women on the cover. So I was like, yeah, close enough. This is like a Japanese record, I guess. So I've avoided hearing Sparks my whole entire life. I had no idea what this band sounded like going into this. I know for some reason, I don't know why, but they had kind of a resurgence several years ago where people were talking about them again.
Yeah.
And I think at that time I was like, maybe I should check out this band. And here we are at least 10 years later. And I don't remember why that happened or I never listened to it, even though I literally own the record and I had it in my hands the other day. And I just, you know, I never bothered to listen to it. However, I will say, if I had a list of my top five favorite record covers of records I've never listened to, this might be number one. This is one of my favorite record covers of all time. Wow. I fucking love this record cover. It's there were some women that were in like a touring, like I guess kabuki troupe. I don't even know if it's kabuki. I don't want to sound racist that it was some fucking kabuki troupe, but they were touring for some kind of like, you know, dance shit in England. And they took this photo. And they're just against this gross green background. And the one woman, like, holding her face and, like, kind of in the Kevin McAllister Home Alone thing. But, like, but like stretching her face out. And she just looks crazy. And the other woman's, like, jutting her stomach out. And I don't know. I just think this is one of
the... She looks pregnant almost. Like, she's really pushing that stomach out.
Yeah. It's just a fucking... And just, the kimonos they're wearing and just everything. And it's like, a beautiful record cover. And so that never enticed me to actually listen to the record, though. So but either way... I did not know what to expect going into this. I honestly, if I had a gun to my head, if I was on Jeopardy and somebody said, what does Sparks sound like? I would have probably said they sounded like either the Rolling Stones or what like the Strokes would have sounded like in 1974.
Right.
That is not the case at all. They don't sound anything like any of that stuff. This is very theatrical music. This is almost like they were writing a record for... non-existent movie or musical even, and it's very Queen-esque. I would throw a little David Bowie in there. Ironically, while I was reading the Wikipedia, I found out that one of these women on the cover went on to sing backup vocals for David Bowie, so that's a pretty crazy tidbit. But this is very, you know, it's very I don't know if intricate's the right word, but it's very intricate, like theatrical type of music. And I was kind of going in this expecting like I would hear it and be like, oh, there's going to be six songs on here that I've heard 1,000 times. Nope, that's not the case. I've never heard any of this shit before. This is all brand new to me. I am not a big person into musicals. I'm not really big into people writing things as if it was for a musical. Right. Outside of, I will make an exception. I'm probably going to bring him up again. But I really like Harry Nilsson. And I think that guy is fucking amazing. And everything he does, I'm just like, that's perfect. This is not Harry Nilsson to me. This is Sparks. And I think the big difference between Sparks and Harry Nilsson, outside of the music being vastly different and this being more of a Queen kind of just insane kind of production, is that there's no hits. There's no hits for Sparks. There's a lot of hot B-sides, I would say. Like, and you know, I can relate to that as a human being. I feel like in my personal catalog, I have a lot of hot B-sides, and I don't have any hits either. So I could relate to Sparks on that level where they recorded this just fucking crazy operatic, insane album, but whoever what was the record, I don't even know what record label it's on, but whatever, whoever the record label head was like, I Island. Guess we don't, yeah, Island, we don't care if you have any hits. So they just let this go without any hits. The single was a song called "The Town." This Town Ain't Big Enough for the Both of Us. I would definitely not say that. That's probably my fifth or sixth favorite song on this whole record, so that was a bad idea. It it peaked at number 2 on the UK pop charts, which is like the New York bestsellers list. Like, you just write a book, and it's going to be on the New York bestsellers list. So the fact that this couldn't even hit number 1 in their, like, adopted home country is kind of sad, honestly. Speaking of which, these guys have a very weird accent, or this guy has a very weird accent. I think they're brothers, though, so I would say both of them. But if you read their Wikipedia, they just say they're from California, and that it's like they're like the Coneheads, basically. Everything I read was just like, yeah, they're from California. That's not a California accent this guy has. So I don't think it's a fake accent or anything, but it's not an American accent. It's not a British accent. It's something, though. So, yeah, I didn't hate this or anything. This is music that I feel like I can understand why there's probably people out there that this is like extremely their shit. Mm-hmm. And I understand that. I'm not built for this type of music. Personally, if there's no hits, like I said, Harry Nilsson could write songs for imaginary movies and still pump out hits. But there's no, even if you wanted to put it into like a Queen perspective, there's no Another One Bites the Dust on this. There's nothing like that. There's nothing for the masses on this, basically. And I respect them for 1974 writing this wild ass album. And I'm sure if I went through the whole Sparks discography, there's probably a lot of music they made that's more catered towards my tastes.
Yeah.
So I don't absolutely hate this or anything. And I think it's a very interesting album, but I'm glad I finally listened to it. But it's, you know, I am really sad that there's no hits. It's just crazy music, crazy over the top opera theatrical music with no actual mainstream hits on it. But yeah, I would have absolutely hated this when I was 14, 16, probably up until, you know, probably 27. I would have probably fucking absolutely hated this. But I'm glad I finally listened to it. I'm gonna probably check out their other music because, like I said, there's probably something they wrote down the line that I'd be more into. For 1974, I think this sounds great, but overall, not for me. But I still love the cover; it's still one of my favorite covers. But what did you think, Scott? Were you familiar with Sparks before we went into this episode?
This is like a couple episodes ago. I talked about how the Wipers all of a sudden were on everybody's lips.
Yeah,
and it's like the same thing. All of a sudden, everyone was like, "Oh, Sparks is so awesome!" and like posting YouTubes of Sparks and stuff like. Like they'd always been into Sparks. How'd you get into Sparks? Because they've never been on the radio. Like they were never, you know, there was no avenue to get into Sparks other than YouTube. To me, like if you've never heard this album, it sounds exactly like if Killer Queen, the song, and Bat Out of Hell, the album, met at the school from Fame and formed a band. So man, it's like really the
most
theatrical.
Perfect, yeah, that's the most perfect description.
There's a weird thing about Sparks where people who like Sparks, like if you like Sparks, there's a good chance we have something in common. Whether I like Sparks or not, we probably have something in common. Like we like some of the same things. It's just like, it's like an indicator. And I like this. This is awesome. You know, this is like very Baroque, sophisticated, crazy, interesting, adventurous pop music. And like sometimes they really nail it. Sometimes they do more new wavy stuff and just more, you know, operatic, like they just really go for it with the crazy melodies. And sometimes it just kind of sounds like theatrical 50s rock, and that, I don't really care about that. I just don't, that's not going to land for me. His voice is really like precious, kind of, you know, it's like, you know, it's like really specific. It really lands. It sounds like he's doing a bit. It sounds like he's playing like a 50s house lady or something like that. You know, it's but it's not bad. It's cool. So, you know, the whole thing is it's fine. And, you know, I knew this album. I've tried with Sparks and I like it, but I don't ever feel like I want to listen to it. But it's really modern sounding, I think. Like,
yeah,
this sounds like it could have been recorded at any time in history. The guitars and the drums, when they kick in, they're very glam and like heavy and produced very well. And it could have been from any time. It could have been from any time ever. The synths, all the stuff, the production is flawless. Like Ron Mael is he's the more like Charlie Chaplin looking brother. Like that's the gag, is that the singer, Russell, I think it's Russell, is more like he looks like the singer of REO Speedwagon or something like that with the big floofy hair. And then Ron looks like Charlie Chaplin with this really serious, sinister face. And you know, he scowls. He plays it up, but never talks. I think he just sits behind his keyboard and doesn't really engage with the crowd or whatever. But so they have a bit. They're a two-man act with, you know, I assume with the band that follows them around or whatever. The reason that I know them and the reason that all Faith No More fans from the 90s know them is that they put out, I think, a greatest hits album called Plagiarism in 1997 that for some reason they had Faith No More come do two songs with them.
Yeah, I saw on their Wikipedia they have some kind of Faith No More versus Sparks album or something like that. I figured that's how you would know them.
It came out of nowhere. This came out of nowhere. There was no way to know stuff like this back then because there was no internet or whatever. But, you know, I'm actually, you know, I can't remember the whole timeline. But basically, if you like, you know, Angel Dust era Faith No More, they put out this, like Sparks, I think it was a big deal. Like they hadn't been around for a while and they just dropped this greatest hits album and it was like funny and clever. The cover was funny. You know, it was kind of like they hadn't lost a step. You know, it was cool. Like people were like, oh, wow, Sparks is back. And, you know, and for some reason they had Faith No More do two songs with them. And they do two songs that are already on the album. So you already have them. And they don't really do much with it. They just add Faith No More. So the original This Town Ain't Big Enough for the Both of Us sounds really good. It sounds modern. It sounds well produced. Faith No More joins. It gets a little bit heavier. But what you get is the best of Mike Patton that you could ever hope for. Like, even if you're a fan of Faith No More, this is what you always wanted from Mike Patton. You're going to get a tear in your eye. If you've never heard this song, open up YouTube. I'm sure it's on there. Look for This Town Ain't Big Enough for the Both of Us featuring Faith No More. You're going to be like, wow, this is all I ever wanted for him. You know, it's absolutely perfect. It's maybe the best thing that they ever did because it's like really tasteful. It just augments the song. It doesn't hurt it. It doesn't do anything wrong with it. Mike Patton joins the singer. He adds a little like oomph and a little edge to it. Doesn't do anything else. He doesn't bark or chirp or quack or squeak or scream or like have like Dave Lombardo play a blast beat. Nothing stupid happens. They play the song dead straight, a little bit heavier, but pretty close. And Mike Patton beefs up the vocals and it's wonderful. It's absolutely. I bought the CD when I was a broke scrub in the 90s because it was so good, but I never listened to the rest of the CD. It wasn't until way later, like I heard, oh, you know, Sparks is kind of like, you know, Queen and kind of crazy. You know, they're like this really baroque, interesting, you know, sophisticated pop band. And then I listened to it. I was like, oh yeah, this is cool. Like it's awesome. It's really cool. It's worth your time. Check it out. And maybe you're like me and it's not for you.
I don't want to sound like I hate on this because it's very interesting and I'm glad I listened to it and I'm sure they have music that is more for me. But do you agree that there's no hits on this though? Do you think I'm correct in saying that?
This Town Ain't Big Enough for the Both of Us is supposed to be the hit, like you said, and it's nope.
That's their most popular song on Spotify too. So this is like the consensus hit. And yeah, that's not even my favorite. Like, I like that song Barbecutie. I think that's probably one of the more 50s sounding songs, but I don't care. I think that's like a really good song.
How people know that. I really like write, like, please break the silence. Email me at borderbosseternal@gmail.com, borderbossrip on Twitter and Instagram.
There's a dare internet friend I have out there named Andrew, and I don't know if he actually listens to All Holes Filled, but when I posted the teaser for this, he said that this is one of my top five albums of all time. So hopefully, if he listens to this episode, or if anybody listens to this episode, like Scott said, let us know. Let us know what blows your dick back about Sparks.
I don't fucking get that, man.
Really can't get old. Really can't get old. Really can't get old. Without a nice scream.